Hey everybody, before we get to our interview with Brian McClellan, I need to issue a correction. In our previous episode about the Hugos and other topics, we mistakenly said that Joanna Russ had been ignored by the awards community, particularly the Nebula and the Hugo. This is demonstrably false by historical record, and I would like to correct that. We also said that she was writing in the 60s. That's also not true. She was writing, well, at least some of her most important works were written in the 70s. She was also writing in the 80s and elsewhere. But in any case, so she did in fact get a Nebula Award for When It Changed and was nominated for Hugo that same year for the same story. That story, if you've read The Female Man, is rather important to it. The Female Man was also nominated in 76 for a Nebula. And she's received numerous other awards, including Nebula, Hugo nominations, etc. And she's also got retrospective awards for the James Tiptree for Female Man and When It Changed. This because the James Tiptree didn't start awarding until 1991, and obviously in 1975 when The Female Man came out, it's kind of, unless you had a time machine, I guess it wouldn't have worked. So we wanted to apologize for getting that information wrong. I should have double-checked it before we kind of let it fly, and I should have known better since I'm teaching The Female Man. I take full responsibility for that, and hope that everybody will at least give us a break on making that just boneheaded mistake. We will try our best not to do that in the future, particularly since doing that, implying that she had received less credit for her work, at least from our community, than she deserved at the time, is just unfair, not just to Joanna Russ, but also to a host of women who have in fact been ignored, and we made the false impression. So, in any case, I do hope that everybody will go read some Joanna Russ, because The Female Man and When It Changed are damn good stories, so you should go read it, and thank you for listening, and enjoy the interview.
It's one small step for man,
but the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 142.
Revolutions, Powder Mages, and Not the Bees with Brian McClellan.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And obviously, our special guest today is Brian McClellan. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
So your new book, The Promise of Blood, well, there's no "the," it's just Promise of Blood. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why I inserted "the" in there. That was weird. Coming out from Orbit, it actually just is about to drop, actually, on Tuesday. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this particular book? Just kind of give us an idea of what is this book about? What's the big deal?
So Promise of Blood is a epic fantasy, and the premise behind it is that that this fantasy magical world has progressed into the industrial age, and so there's magic and kind of all the classic fantasy tropes. But in addition to all of that, we've gotten gunpowder. There's muskets. The workers' unions, and there's new things going on in the world, and everything's changing. And so the book starts with a revolution where one of the main characters, Field Marshal Tomas, performs a coup against his king. And the rest of the book is deals with the fallout of that coup.
Yeah, and that actually, because of you brought up the coup first, I think that's the first thing I actually want to ask you about. Because this is like the very first chapter, is it takes place right in the middle of the coup, or right after the main aspects of the coup have taken place in terms of they've stormed in and killed all the bad guys, the quote-unquote bad guys. And I was really interested with the fact that one of the underlying sort of conflicts, it's not made center, but one of the reasons that Tomas actually does – commits the coup is because he perceives the Menhush, the king, is basically selling out the people of Adro to the Kez, which is a neighboring kingdom. And this is via a trade agreement because, as we learn, shouldn't surprise us, the king has basically spent his kingdom into debt. Into massive debt. And so the trade agreement is to, we'll be friends with the Kez and then they'll own us, essentially. And that's why Tomas is pissed off. And I'm really interested in this idea of, because we don't get a lot of this kind of stuff in a lot of fantasy. It's usually, especially fantasy with so much magic as this world has, you don't get that kind of political underlying stuff as often as you do and other kinds of fantasy. So I'm curious, what were you thinking about the kinds of real world conflicts that were occurring in our own world during that kind of early industrial age? And I'm thinking specifically like the French Revolution and things like that. Was that something you were thinking of?
Oh yeah, certainly. I mean, I took a lot of inspiration from, you know, that whole era, you know, the French Revolution, and tried to kind of work different aspects into it. I obviously didn't want to just, you know, copy the French Revolution and put it into a second world. But I definitely took a lot of inspiration from it, just in different events that happen and, you know, kind of the way that, you know, the kingdom was changing hands, you know, the government changing hands almost, you know, overnight at times. There's just so much going on in that area. In terms of, you know, all the political stuff, the wars and, you know, invasions and counter invasions. And the French Revolution was a huge inspiration for the book.
Were you also at all, this is kind of just a weird side question, were you at all influenced by any contemporary movements or issues?
I don't think so. Okay. Not terribly.
I just thought that it was interesting because, I mean, there's the financial issue and a certain degree of hostility that is had between many of the different groups and the kinds of a lot of those issues, I think, in a weird way resonate with some of the stuff going on in the world now, even though they're not obviously like that. We're not running around with like muskets and shooting at each other. Thankfully, that would really suck. But I don't know, maybe it'll resonate with audiences in that way too. They'll kind of see the kind of chaos in parts of our own world occurring here as well, particularly since I think of like the Arab Spring, where, I mean, people were being overthrown. They weren't literally kings, but suddenly finding themselves on the wrong side of history, as it were. One of the other things that I did find really interesting is this is the first novel I have read since a Lloyd Alexander novel. I think it was called The Kestrel, in which there wasn't even magic in that. Never mind. This is the only novel I've ever read that actually takes seriously the concept of a kind of industrializing society with muskets and those kinds of that kind of weaponry, but also a very serious magical system in terms of it's actually very ubiquitous. There are different classes of magic, and I'm really curious what was kind of the impetus for creating a world that was these what we perceive to be in opposition, these two different worlds, but yet are clearly very integrated here.
I didn't see them as in opposition. I've gotten a lot of comments from people, you know, online and stuff saying that, you know, guns don't belong in epic fantasy and that the whole point of epic fantasy is, you know, a non-industrialized world. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I set out to write the book really wanting to kind of explore, you know, what happens to this, you know, to an old medieval magical world when, you know, they do start to advance technologically. You know, a lot of people will say that, you know, kind of magic tends to keep that advancing from happening because magic kind of fills in for technology in a lot of ways. But, you know, I kind of put that to one side and said, okay, but what if it does? What if, you know, all the technology, you know, advances just like it did in our world? You know, you get the printing press and gunpowder and all these things that, you know, change so much. So I felt like that they could work really well together, and that the era that it was in, the Napoleonic era, is not so far advanced that you lose kind of some of those epic tropes.
Yeah, and I agree. I don't think that they're, personally, I don't see them in opposition, but I think people would, like, as you said, people who would say, like, you can't have magic and guns, and it's like, why not? It works. Leave it alone. It's fun.
Well, I did get a vibe, Brian, in the novel that the Privileged and the Powder Mages just do not get along. It's more of a personal conflict. The Privileged don't think the Powder Mages are really magicians, per se. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different paradigm. So there is that conflict there, don't you think?
Yeah, and there's the Privileged also fear the Powder Mages because it's new magic and nobody likes competition. When you're strong enough and powerful enough that you can level city blocks with a wave of your hand, suddenly having somebody that can shoot you from a mile away, you won't even hear the gunshot. That would scare you. That would scare anybody. And so the Privileged, have a very strong opposition. And they're also allergic to gunpowder. Most of them have kind of some kind of allergy to it, makes their skin itch and their, nose puff up and things like that. And so they don't like that at all.
And I think it says at one point too, that the distance at which a Privileged powers is effective is was a half mile or something.
Yeah, more like about a half mile.
So even that, I mean, if ever there was a quote unquote war between Privileged and Powder Mages, there would already be the Privileged. There's a line somewhere in there that basically the Privileged believe that they don't like being at any sort of disadvantage, and that distance alone is what puts them at a huge disadvantage.
Yeah.
Paul, did you have another question about, or do we want to move to a different topic?
Oh, just a slightly different point from what you were saying before, Sean. I can only think of a couple authors who have brought magic and technology in this particular time frame, Martha Wells and Paula Volsky. There must be others. Was there any literary inspirations, Brian, in mixing these two together, or are you just forging a path on your own without awareness of the few predecessors there have been that have explored 18th century history and technology with magic?
There were no real inspirations for that. I wasn't aware of anyone at the time. I've since been told about some of the kind of the gun magic and I think it's the Warhammer universe, I want to say, and then I think Chris Evans.
Iron Elves, yeah, that's the one I was forgetting of, yeah.
I hadn't heard of any of that before I was writing this, before I was pretty much close to being published. So it was all kind of going on my own and just kind of mixing all of that medieval epic fantasy that I love with some of my other favorite books of Les Miserables and The Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, that's interesting. I think maybe Naomi Novik.
That's another good one. Temeraire.
Set during the Napoleonic Wars, I think. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Brian.
Oh, okay. I did know about Naomi Novik, but I wasn't counting her because of historical fantasy. I kind of see differently as epic fantasy.
That's a fair point. Yeah.
And there is a lot of historical fantasy that takes place in 16, 17, and 1800s.
Yeah, and I think the big difference between a lot of fantasy set during that era is between yours and other kind of work is that in a lot of work when magic appears in the kind of like either the Victorian era or something or even early 1800s, that kind of stuff, the magic is almost always kind of this, it's like this evil. It's not a part of the world it's sort of like ghost story kind of stuff. Like where the magic is, it's not as well known to the world at large, whereas here the world is effectively been changed by the presence of magic. It's like any other epic fantasy world, except that we've now moved it ahead, 100, 200, 300 years, something like that. Well, probably even more than that, but yeah. I like that. So I should just say that I enjoy stuff that is different, that plays around with guns and magic, because that would be me. I'd be a powder mage. I'd be snorting so much gunpowder.
You have to be careful with it, though.
Man, don't ruin my dreams. Come on.
I'm sorry.
actually, Paul kind of brought this up. With the magic, in the way in which you've actually constructed this whole system, it has, if I recall correctly, there are three quote-unquote tiers of magic. There are the privileged who have the most access to what you call the else, which is kind of like your magic plane where people draw their powers, is, in a sense. And then you have the knacked who are kind of, they get individual kind of powers, but they're kind of mundane stuff. So like one guy can he never needs to sleep. Another character can detect magic users. Another character might just be able to make your coffee warm.
Exactly.
And then of course you have your powder mages, which is this newer version who basically if there's gunpowder around, they can make that shit explode. And there's actually a great scene when that happens when Taniel actually reaches out and finds a bunch of gunpowder and blows a couple people up in kind of desperation. That's his only course of action. And I'm interested in all of these kinds of magic, tiers of magic. I mean, were you thinking that there would be initially like a hierarchy would develop and then that the powder mages would be kind of a threat to that hierarchy?
Yeah, definitely. The privileged, I mean, I kind of correspond each of the magics with a class. And so the privileged would be the magic of the nobility, and the powder mages are kind of the rising middle class, and the knacked are the power of the lower classes. You know, common.
That's interesting. Okay.
That is interesting. I didn't make that connection. What about the types of magic we get a glimpse of that don't fall into this tripartite structure?
Oh, like Cuphole, yeah.
Like Cuphole and well, the gods.
Well, the gods actually are, their magic, the magic that they have access to is basically trumped up privileged sorcery. It's the same thing times 1,000. But Cuphole is something completely different. And it's very foreign, and nobody knows anything about it. And throughout most of the book, in fact, throughout the whole book, you don't really know what she can do and what she can't do. And it makes it quite a bit of fun because it's, the privileged are already dealing with, the powder mages that have come about in the last couple hundred years, and they, they don't like this, and they still consider it very new. And then, Cuphole comes on the scene. And it's completely different from anything they've seen before.
I found that interesting that you go into detail about these three kinds of magic in a very Brandon Sanderson sort of way, sort of detailing their limitations, their powers, their weaknesses, and then you throw in Cuphole just out of nowhere. It seems almost chaotic and almost feels like it came from another world, literally. And dropped into this one.
Yeah.
And I think that has a lot to do with one of the things I'm actually curious about is there is an undercurrent throughout the novel about the kind of nature of knowledge, about what people take down, what people write down. I mean, there's a particular scene with Adamat, who we haven't talked about yet, goes to one of the major libraries of Adipest, the main city where the coup is taking place, and he's talking to, I think the name is Uskin, and trying to find these books. And what you're discovering is that the powder mages, there's almost no scholarship on them because the privileged don't want any of that. They don't want the study being done. And there's also a certain extent to which nobody knows anything about Cuphole because they perceive Cuphole's people as savages. They're not using real magic. They're just these savage people over there, and we're not going to study them. And that's kind of this, what has been taken down, and of course, even to some extent, what you can destroy, since that's one of the other kind of subplots is when you destroy the information, that this kind of ancient information, it throws a kink, I guess, into Adamet's life because he's trying to find information that pretty much can only be found in books at least at the start. So, and I don't know if you had thought about that as that there was kind of an argument or conflict over access to knowledge or something along those lines.
Well, certainly, and and that goes back to the privileged, very much trying to, kind of cut off power and access to the Powder Mages. Adro is the only country in the Nine that actually has, an organized branch of the government that are Powder Mages, an organized branch of the army anyways. And everywhere else, Powder Mages are at best tolerated and at worst, hunted like animals. And the only reason that it's like that in Adro is because of Field Marshal Tomas. He's the darling of, everyone. Everybody loves him because he's been such a successful campaigner and he's so good at what he does. And his rise to the power was, the rise of power of the Powder Mages. And it's nowhere else is it anything like that.
That makes me really depressed now.
Well, no, it doesn't make me depressed. It's an interesting study in that how one man's charisma and ambition and competence can change a society. Adro is the only country. We get barely any looks at any others that really has Powder Mages in any real shape, sense, or form. And he's responsible for that. He's changed the course of history twice now, in a sense.
Yeah, and I wanted, I don't spend a lot of time on the king, Manhau. He was actually a very progressive king. He allowed the unions to take hold. Again, the only place in the Nine that anything like that happened, he allowed Tomas to form his own powder cabal of mages. And so he was a fairly progressive king, but he was also a complete idiot and just, he spent every penny that the country had and had no interest in the government itself. And so, his few progressive items were kind of more of a, oh yeah, that sounds cool. Go ahead and do it kind of thing. And obviously they came back to bite him.
Yeah. Yeah. In more ways than one. He does lose certain things. I will say no more. That scene was, I think, the moment in which I went, oh, yeah, there's some French Revolution stuff going on right here. Not that he was the only one to lose that part. But I do think it's interesting about Tomas, too, that on the one hand, he is this charismatic leader. Everybody kind of loves him. They see him as a good guy for the most part, in terms of just being really good at what he does, but he's apprehensive about the power. He essentially, in the beginning, after the coup happens, he sits down with all of the people who helped plan it with him, and he said, "You all are gonna be running this stuff. I don't want to do it. Like, I didn't want to be the king. I just kind of wanted this idiot to go away so that we could have a better world."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting in a lot of ways, because of course that what follows is this very deliberate sense in which he's trying to appease the people by giving them, letting them have their moment of like chaotic, animalistic violence, where he just lets them basically storm through the particularly the nobility's district, the district where all their happy houses are, and lets them just like go to town, do whatever the hell you want. And then at some point we'll crack down, but for now, let them do whatever. Just let them have fun. It's almost like if this were a soccer game, like the mayor of a town after a loss, just let them go. Just let them riot, flip some cars, and then we'll crack down later. Don't worry.
No, Tomas, I loved the character, creating the character of Tomas. Because he's a very, an interesting kind of dichotomy of, being, having very good intentions, but he can be a very, brutal person. And he, he kind of sees things as, you know, the cost, is it worth it in the end? And, you know, ends justify the means kind of a guy. And, you know, obviously he has, you know, his kind of darker shadows. He was very fun to write because, I don't see a lot of characters in books that literally answer to no one. Because, you know, if you have a character like that, you know, absolute power, they're obviously going to be the bad guy. But I didn't want Tomas to be the bad guy. I wanted him to be the good guy. You know, at least from our, you know, perspective. So it was a great deal of fun to write.
Tomas does seem like to be the first character you came up with. Is that right? In conceiving Primus of Blood?
Some of the characters changed over time. Technically, Taniel was the first character, but he kind of, you know, he kind of became different in subsequent drafts. And Tomas was probably the first fully realized character. Like, he is exactly the same as, you know, when I first had the idea for the character.
In some ways, he takes a back seat as far as being a man of action to the other two characters. So I was going to bridge to say, so who really came next, the Inspector or Toriel Two-Shot? And you've answered that. Was Toriel always going to be Tomas' son? Did you have that baked in from the beginning?
That kind of, yeah, it was, you know, I developed the character of Taniel, and then he, you know, I thought, okay, well, I want this to be the coup, and, you know, who is doing the coup, performing the coup, and I, you know, I thought, okay, a field marshal, and then, oh, you know, that's Taniel's dad, and that was, you know, kind of a, you know, interesting moment that I figured that out, and then as I created, you know, Taniel's dad, I realized that this character is somebody who I want to actually be in their head. I want them to be a viewpoint character. And that was really fun to, you know, suddenly go from him being a character that was going to be very much a side character and to one of the protagonists.
Yeah. And I think he's one of my favorite characters because he's got a cool like nickname, Taniel Two-Shot, which is kind of cool. What I thought was really interesting about him is both because of his relationship with his father, which is, you know, he's got daddy issues. just to make a joke about it. But yeah, I mean, there is this kind of tense relationship between them. Part of that, I think, derived from Taniel's quote-unquote love life. There's a sense to which Taniel, I think, doesn't want to be controlled by Tomas, and in many ways is very much like his father without even realizing it. I find him so interesting too, because as we talked about earlier, Taniel is essentially a reflection of precisely what the Privileged are terrified about with the Powder Mages, because he's really good at killing Privileged. He is not just really good, he is probably the best.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting, you know. So on the one hand, he's got these kinds of relationship issues, which is nice that you kind of brought that in to kind of make him a more complex, rounded character. But also, there's this aspect of his, he becomes this figurehead for an idea, or a figurehead for a fear that is not really manifested, because we don't have the privilege to like go, oh my god, I'm terrified, like all over the time. But it's there. In his kind of existence, he is the moment which we recognize what the change is going to look like, what this new world is going to become.
Mm-hmm.
I think so, but there wasn't a question there. I was just rambling.
Taniel, I relate to Taniel because he's only a few years younger than me, he's at that point in his life, you know, and there's a scene where he reflects on exactly this, where he's killing people and he's in these brutal fights and he's thinking, what the hell am I doing? I should be at the university. I should be studying and, you know, trying to meet new girls and, you know, maybe courting someone and getting ready to be married. and instead I'm, you know, killing people and finishing them off after a battle, and, you know, what is wrong with my life?
Yeah, I mean, he is one of the very conflicted characters, but he has a different conflict than I think his father does in that sense, because his conflicts are seemingly more personal. Although I guess there's a certain extent to which one of Thomas's motivations is a personal motivation, even though he keeps refusing it. But we all know it's true.
Yeah, yeah. Tomas does not want anyone thinking of him as doing this for anything but professional reasons. He's a very professional person, and he loves his country, and his job is to protect his country. And that's, you know, and that's what he did this for, you know, at least that he'll admit to anyone else.
And yet you then turn around and you have someone who is doing stuff, a lot of his stuff, for personal reasons. That's the good inspector.
Mm-hmm.
Did you set up that that reverse mirror on purpose?
Probably not, no. I did want, Inspector Automat is someone who I purposefully wanted him to be, you know, kind of a more intimate character. He's not working on a level of, you know, kings and nobility and, you know, all these high, you know, people. He's, you know, he's down in the nitty-gritty trying to, you know, find answers. And so he was supposed to be a more kind of personal character, in terms of his, you know, kind of personal motivations, then, you know, that just kind of ended up happening.
Because I found that really interesting. Tomas is doing stuff supposedly for the country, although he has a very good reason to hate the Kez, and Toriel has his complex motivations. And then you have the inspector who fully does stuff, including stuff that he shouldn't be doing for the sake of his family. He's put his family first, and that seemed in very strong contrast to the doth protest too much out of Tomas and Toriel.
Yeah, no, he, you know, Automat is, you know, he loves his country and he tries to be a good citizen, but, you know, the end all be all of his existence is his family. You know, he's got a bunch of kids and he's got a great wife, and, you know, that's the reason why he gets up in the morning. And so, you know, that, and that's the reason why he's, you know, doing the work he's doing, is to keep them, you know, fed and safe and, keep his house and all of that.
Yeah. It goes to kind of, it's almost as if you have, a cast of characters whose motivations and desires, can connect with a variety of readers at the same time. I mean, like, you know, somebody who is a very family-oriented person would connect with Automat. Somebody who perhaps is more country-oriented would possibly connect with Tomas. And somebody who maybe is in that not quite adolescent phase, but that phase where you don't really know where you're supposed to be, and those kinds of family conflicts and figuring your place in all of this would connect with Taniel. I don't know if that was intentional, but it certainly seems
that was intentional. Actually, I wanted to have each character kind of appeal to almost a different demographic. And it's funny because Tomas is, you know, in his 60s. He's my dad's age, and my dad actually relates more to Automat, because Automat is the, you know, he's a working man, and cares about his family. And I thought that was interesting.
We are neglecting Neela, though, who's the fourth major point of view character in this.
Mm-hmm.
And her story is almost at odds with Tomas. I mean, there's very little direct intersection, but her story does get wrapped up with his. Where did she come from?
I actually had a fear of writing a female character as one of the major point of view characters, because I really didn't want to do it wrong my first time. In all the writing I've ever done, it's always been male point of views, because, you know, that's what I'm comfortable with. And Neela came about because, well, So she is a point of view character, but she's not a major one. She, I think, of the whole book is maybe, a tenth of the word count, as opposed to, more like a third of the other guys. And so Neela is almost an experiment for me to try to, test my skill as an author, writing a female point of view. And but I wanted her to be completely different from any of the others. If Adamat's a working man, he's still, kind of a pillar of his community, and he's been around for a long time. Neela is young, and she's just a washerwoman, and she has no family in the area. She doesn't have a lot of friends, and so it gives her a completely different perspective of what happens when suddenly the entire country is just changed overnight.
Yeah, you kind of mentioned it a little bit earlier, but you said that you were afraid of trying to write a female character. What did you find most difficult about trying to write Neela's perspective?
As dumb as it is, it wasn't kind of as difficult and intimidating as I thought it was going to be. I have read a lot of things that are critical of authors who write bad female characters. And I think she came out pretty well. I didn't want it to be perceived as just another man with a female name, because there are some authors who write their female characters exactly like that. It wasn't as bad as I thought, and the challenge was just kind of getting in her head and figuring out what her motivations are. She's younger than any of the other viewpoint characters, and is in a different place in her life. And I have absolutely no perspective on that, personally. I can kind of get in the heads of all the other characters, just because I'm a guy that can kind of try to think that way. But women have a very different perspective, some of them anyways, and I wanted her to have a very different perspective. So, I talked a lot with my wife about her and tried to kind of develop her character differently.
And that actually brings up something that Paul and I were talking before we brought you on before recording, that one of the characters who doesn't have a point of view is Flora, who... we just won't ruin her perspective. Yeah. Just people read the book and you'll find out why Valora is important. And Paul was curious if you, and I'm just going to speak for you, Paul, so take that. he was kind of curious, and I am too, actually, if she is going to appear again in the next novel or later books, since this is a trilogy, so maybe even later, is she going to appear in more concentrated form, and or possibly will she have her own POV?
In book two, she does not have her own POV, but she does appear far more. She is more important to the narrative quite a bit. Valora originally was supposed to be either a point of view character or a very important, constantly on screen kind of character. And it just didn't work. In early drafts, that's how she was, and it just wasn't working at all. And so I decided to go ahead and kind of push her to the background and have her actions and everything happening behind the scenes. But when I first decided to go ahead and push her back a little bit, I did want, I knew that I was going to have her more prominent in the second book.
Fair enough. I was hoping for a point of view from her, because I would love to know what's running around in her head, especially given her relationship with Tomas and Toriel. But if the words will not flow, the words will not flow.
No, I really did want to do that, and it just did not work. I tend to be a fairly intuitive writer, and there are some times when I can't pinpoint why something's not working, but it's just not working, and that was one of those times. and I ended up cutting most of her stuff from the first book. And I wish I had been able to keep it. I really liked a lot of it, but it just didn't work within the narrative.
Maybe we'll still kind of get a sense of her motivations and desires without having her POV.
Yeah, and I think you do in the second book. She is one of the reasons why I ended up cutting her is because she's very much in the same place as Tanyel is. I mean, they're the same age, and they both kind of don't know what their place in the world is. And I didn't want to repeat that in a point of view character. I didn't want to kind of repeat that same, the same sort of motivations and struggles. But she does, you do see a lot more of what's going on in her head in the second book.
Awesome. That'll make Paul very, very happy.
It will.
Yep. He cried a little bit while reading. Because
it's understandable.
I'm teasing you, Paul.
This is what we do, Brian. I was curious what your inspirations for the geography, both macro and micro, were. I was particularly taken with the Mountain Cressum and the city in the caldera and the monastery halfway up, and the whole geography looks kind of Europe-ish, but not. I mean, you could put Adro as France, but then is the Kez Spain? I was just curious where the inspirations for geography came from, both large and small.
Well, in terms of country-wise, it's actually more almost Kez is almost more French in a lot of ways, just geography-wise, not necessarily how their country is or anything. Whereas Adro is more Switzerland, much, much smaller, very much ringed with mountains and insular, and Adro doesn't have, a port or anything like that. They have a very large lake that they, the capital lives on, sits on. But they don't have direct access to the sea, which changes a lot of things, but they have a lot of minerals and, of the coal and the iron and all that stuff because of all the mountains. So that's how it was geography wise. The mountain, South Pike Mountain, actually comes from it, and that was one of the earliest things in the book that the earliest ideas I came up with was, having part of the book take place on this giant mountain, and that's actually inspired by Kilimanjaro. Just something that rises so, high above all the rest of the geography, that it just kind of dominates, the skyline. Kind of that, the caldera on top, I can't remember what it's called though, but I spent a lot of time looking at, photos online on, Google images of calderas, different calderas, and kind of putting them all together and, thinking about how they all work and what caused them, volcanic wise, things like that. I love, in terms of, scenery and stuff, I actually have a giant folder on my computer that's all just, pictures, high definition pictures of, mountain ranges and valleys and plains and all these different things that just, because, I can't necessarily travel to all these places, but I'm a visual writer, and so I like to see what I'm thinking about.
That's very cool. I do like topography, and both photographically, personally, and in books. And when I saw the mountain, my first inspiration was those. I was thinking of the world of Exalted and the giant Imperial Mountain, the city halfway up. But then you put the city in the caldera. It's like, so it's not quite that. But I was very much struck by this giant mountain out of nowhere that the action with Toriel revolves around, and I was very much taken by it. But I didn't make the Switzerland connection, maybe because the sense of scale. I thought Adro was larger than it was. Maybe I just didn't grok that properly. I was thinking Adro was France, okay, Kez is maybe Spain, but ring by mountains and having a sea/lake in the center, that makes much more an industrialized Switzerland. Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah, and Adro is actually, it's the smallest country of all the nine. It's quite a bit smaller than any of the others. So it it's almost kind of like the little brother that's being picked on.
So that almost gives almost like a William Tell sort of feel with Switzerland fighting off against France and Austria.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
I should pull up the Google Maps.
I'm sorry, Sean.
No. I didn't make the connection myself, but I did pull up the Google Maps because I was really curious about the geography, and it's actually something that is really weird. You know, I never really paid attention to European geography, but there are some mountains over there.
Oh yeah,
I'm looking at it like right through the heart, the southern sort of section of Switzerland. This huge mountain range.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually really, really interesting, because I mean, there are obviously going to be parts of all of that that are very isolated because they'll be in these kind of mountain valleys, which is very similar to what Adro would be like based on the map that's in the book, where it's completely surrounded by mountains. And on the one hand, that would be a strategic advantage, because there are only so many places that you could reasonably pull an army through.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, the other places that are more open, I mean, the only thing keeping Kez from Novi is presumably that river.
Yeah.
And so that changes the relationship. But that also might explain that maybe that lures Adra into a false sense of security, because it thinks it's more safe and it's not. There's a certain degree to which competition does lead to more advancement in terms of military. Because if you're constantly fighting against your neighbors, you got to come up with better bows and arrows, essentially.
Oh yeah, certainly. And Adro is, I had to kind of give them, you know, advantages and disadvantages. And one of their disadvantages is that they are so much smaller, you know, than Kez, and their population is much, much smaller. But they are more industrialized. They've kind of embraced the whole, you know, the unionization and the industrial, you know, advancements, and they also have you know, this very strategic place. I mean, they're essentially a gigantic valley, the country itself, and completely ringed in mountains. And so, you know, they've got, you know, all the high places are all guarded by the Mountain Watch, you know, which you know, they have all of the, they have toll roads and everything and fortresses. And that's one of the reasons why the Kez doesn't like them, is because they're able to, you know, tax everything that goes through the heart of the entire nine. You know, it gives them a lot of advantages, but they are much, much smaller and, you know, have the potential to be steamrolled.
It actually is really, the site talking about the industrial aspects, I do think it was really interesting that Adamat, he had a failed venture creating a steam printing press, which I find so fascinating, because you know, they're printing books in this world, but the steam printing press would be like similar to what happened in the West, where when we invented the mass printing press, it completely changed who had access to all the information, and the steam printing press presumably would do that, because you know, Adamat then would be a very wealthy man, because he'd be producing sexy romance novels for everyone of Adro.
Exactly.
And I find that so interesting, because again, it goes back to that, like, this undercurrent that you know, that who has access to knowledge, and knowledge expanding that knowledge to everyone. And you know, Adamat, you know, his printing press would essentially have been the next thing to change. It wouldn't be the powder mages now. It would be the printing press would change everything, because the powder mages are the current major huge shift, other than the fact that the coup, obviously the shift, but the current major shift in terms of ideology or whatever, population. But the printing press would, if that ever happens, that would so drastically change Adro and every other nation around it, by suddenly giving everyone access to information, because suddenly more people can buy books. They don't have to get university privileges to get to the libraries. Although yes, there is a public library in Adipest, is there not?
Yeah, there is. And the libraries are fairly prominent already in the world. And there's part of the conversation that he has with his university friend is that, you know, more and more bookstores are opening, and people love being able to read, you know, more, you know, more books and having more access, and that, you know, yeah, he would have been, insanely wealthy had his steam printing press actually worked. Because he was the first one to see this new technology and say, well, I would like to invest in that. And he put everything he had into it. He quit his job, you know, working for the police force, and then it kind of blew up in his face.
You don't actually see that very often in fantasy novels, where technological change, even simplistic technological change, is at least a major component of the world as a whole, because it doesn't happen as often. Usually the change is, you know, there's an evil bad guy and everybody's got to climb the giant mountain and go get him, or they got to go get the magic ring, or if there's a change, it's an ideological change. So like, you know, the coup, if the coup had been the only thing in this, it would have been, well, that's the kind of normal thing we expect in a lot of fantasy. But there are so many of these undercurrents where the novel is thinking, or you were thinking about technology as, even in its most rudimentary form, as a vehicle of change, which is just not as common in a lot of fantasy, I think.
It's not, no.
Yeah, the era that I was trying to write in, you know, the Napoleonic era, the Industrial Revolution, I mean, it's just, you know, change was everything during that time period. Changing of governments, changing of technology, changing of, you know, armies, you know, everything was just, you know, in constant flux. And so the time period was such a, you know, rich material for that. And it's a huge theme in our own history of, you know, that early 1800s. And so it was almost impossible not to have that be a major, you know, part of the book.
Yeah. And it remains, technology remains kind of one of the major driving forces for societal change now. I mean, just look at where we are now with all the weird technology we're coming up with. Google glasses. Google glasses are changing the world. May change the world. I mean, people are already thinking about the legal ramifications of wearing Google glasses.
Yeah, and you see people that are afraid of the idea of Google glasses. You know, what if somebody's recording me in secret? And, you know, every time that there's a new technological leap forward, there's always going to be people that, you know, look at it as something really awesome. And there's always going to be people that fear it and shy away from it and try to shout it down. And then there's always going to be people that just don't really care and they go about their lives.
There's actually, and this is kind of not specifically relevant to this particular novel, but it just related to this technological question. There was something, I think it was Tobias Bekel had an article about, there's a police force, and I forget where they are, where the police were wearing these small cameras on their person, which would record their activities. What they found was, even though the police could voluntarily turn these things on, it actually reduced the number of incidences of violence, because they were turning them off when they committed violence. They were actually recording when they, you know, they threw a suspect on the ground or they hit him with a baton or whatever. But they found that for some reason, having that constant surveillance impacted behavior. And to some extent, it almost feels like something like Google Glasses, where anyone in public could be recording you at any time. It would almost be like a passive-aggressive behavior modification of sorts.
And obviously there's, you know, a debate in all of that of, you know, how good is that and how much is it destroying the privacy of the average person? You know, at what point will, you know, every little, you know, gesture or thing we say, you know, be, you know, problematic, you know, possibly come back to haunt us? And at what point is it, you know, beneficial for society? And that's obviously a huge line that countries all over the world are kind of working to discover.
That's the big question of all technological change, really, is how is this going to, what are the good and the bad, and do the pros outweigh the cons?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, everything from, I mean, weaponry
from fire
to,
all the way up, yeah.
Yeah, from weaponry to books to, you know, new modes of transportation, everything to some extent. I mean, that's a question. You know, do we need this? And if we do need it, is it going to be overall beneficial to society, or are we going to be sacrificing too much to bring this technology into our lives?
Yeah, certainly. And I think that, you know, fear has a big place to play, part to play in all of that. You know, fear of other people, or fear of being caught doing something that's, you know, even if it's not illegal or harmful, you know, society may look at you. And I remember there was a few years ago, there was a girl in I believe it was South Korea, who her dog, you know, took a dump on the train, and she didn't pick it up, but somebody had filmed it, and the girl's life was ended up being destroyed over this, because people figured out who she was, and there was a giant backlash about it. And you know, it's kind of a small, I mean, certainly disgusting thing, but it's still very small in, you know, the course of, you know, life. But her whole life was destroyed because of it.
That seems excessive to me. Like, yeah, that's just to use a slur, douchey to leave your dog's doo-doo in the train. But that's not like when those people that – there was that YouTube video of the person throwing the puppies in the river.
Yeah.
And they went after that person. Like, the scale is so drastically – like, the scale of evil is so drastically different. Like, your dog pooping in a train is gross, disgusting, douchey, but not – like
– evil.
It's not evil, evil. It's – nobody, like, yeah, someone might step in it, it might stink up the train, someone had to clean it up, like, it kind of is inconvenient and disgusting, but it's not like if she had taken her dog and thrown him off the train.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's a difference, you know, in what the result should have been. You know, on one hand, she probably should have, you know, had her hand slapped, you know, maybe a fine or something, but, you know, somebody that's throwing puppies into a river should probably be thrown in jail. You know, there's very different, but that's not actually what happens when there's these kind of public, you know, outcries. They, you know, they can overreact like crazy.
Yeah, there's some degree to which we're almost going through like this infant phase of this new technology. I mean, not Google Glasses, but like the idea that so much of our lives is public already. And, you know, we're still trying to figure it out in terms of, like, you know, what do you say online? What is appropriate behavior? Because suddenly, you know, there's anonymity on the internet and anyone can say any stupid thing. But now we've got people who can find out who you are, even though you're anonymous, you know, and it's almost like, yeah, we're at that point where we're going to have to really reconsider, like, do we start scaling our response up to the situation? Or do we just keep going down this destructive path where nobody can do anything stupid without having their lives ruined? And I say stupid in the sense that, like, you know, letting your dog poop in the train, that's stupid. That's not, you know, you shouldn't go to prison for letting your dog poop in a train, unless you do it like you're like a serial dog pooper, in which case, in which case maybe you should go to jail. I don't know. Sorry, we kind of like went a field.
Yeah. Let's go back to more to the book, shall we, Sean?
Yeah,
that might be a good idea.
Yeah, and there is this theme of technological change, technological progress. There's revolution, and then there's although the blurb sort of gives it away. I didn't read the blurb until I was well into the book. There's a left turn that the book takes, in a sense, Brian. In the sense of the theme and what's really going on. And I was curious as to what your motivations were for throwing the whole stuff with the gods and gods returning and upsetting the apple cart of the nine that way.
I part of it was kind of, you know, like a classic fantasy trope kind of thing. And part of it was me wanting to see how an industrial world reacts to, you know, an idea that by now everybody thinks is kind of, you know, silly. You know, everybody, you know, educated people, you know, not many people really go to church anymore and, you know, believe in all of this, you know, kind of mumbo jumbo within the world. And so, you know, what happens when they're faced with the idea that, you know, maybe it's real, maybe some of this ancient history that they kind of think of more in the terms of mythology rather than history. Maybe some of it has some, validity. And what did they do about it?
Fair enough. Not to give stuff away, are these themes going to be the themes of the series, or is this really more going to be more of a shift towards this more epic conflict of old versus new, which is what I'm starting getting the feel here, the old mythology, old gods versus the new industrial revolution. Is that really what this, I'm trying to get into your head, what this series really is about in a way?
In some ways, yeah. And, in a lot of ways, the series is about, how good is change, and, what change is, actually beneficial. And at what point does even beneficial change become too much? When does a swing towards, a new kind of freedom actually become, like almost a prison for the people that, started it?
Fair enough. We'll have to see how it unfolds in the subsequent novels. When is the first novel, as of the recording, this is coming out next Tuesday. When's the second novel coming out?
It'll be out in February of 2014.
Oh wow, so that's
pretty good clip.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's not too bad though. But I find I just gotta say I prefer having time to actually read the damn novel before, like, because when they do those things where someone will write like a 3-book series and they release it one after the other in like a month and a half. Yeah, I don't have time to read it. I'm sorry, because they're usually like 500 page books and they release them so quick. I'm like, no, I can't do it. I'm sorry. I'm going to go read something else. But your book, so in February, which is actually very reasonable, so people can go pick this up and they can marinate in your world.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I believe they're looking for a marinade, yes. I believe they're looking for that 10 months, and then I think it might even be shorter between book 2 and 3, because I think that they're talking about doing it September of 2014.
That'd be
pretty
months.
Quick. Yeah. No, but that's good though. Wow.
Yeah.
Yep. What are you gonna do when you're done, man?
Go to the next thing. That's kind of a big question in the back of my head right now, because book 2 is going to I'm turning it in. The final copy is going in on the 1st, and so it's going into production, and then and then I'll be working on book 3. And so yeah, that whole, what happens after all this is done is definitely in the back of my head. There's a couple of things floating around, some ideas. I mean, I would love to continue writing within this universe. I've had thoughts about, kind of pulling a Joe Abercrombie and having standalone novels in the same universe, or just doing another trilogy. There's options. I've got ideas for, any of those options. I've also got, other worlds that I'd love to explore and, see what's happening. It's fun to create new things, and it's also fun to create, new stuff in the same universe. I mean, in some ways it's easier because, the universe already exists and you've got all these frameworks already. And then in other ways that, it can, if you're not, really freshening things up, it can get boring as an author.
Yeah, that seems to be one of the biggest concerns, I think, even as a reader, would be, okay, they're going to continue in the universe, but are they even doing anything new or interesting with new characters in that universe? Presumably you could. I mean, it just depends on the writer.
The Robin Hobb model. I mean, just about all of our fantasies set in the same universe, but in very different parts and very different characters and very different plots.
And sometimes if you don't realize the novels in her universe are part of the same universe, if you don't know already, you won't realize it.
Yeah.
Because there are certain sections of her work that it's almost like a whole different thing. So, but it seems like based on kind of our discussion about things that you decided to cut out of the novel,
that you would be the first person to put a big X mark on it and said, no, I'm not doing this.
So. Yeah, I've got ideas that I think I would actually quite enjoy writing in the universe for subsequent series or subsequent books. We'll see what happens with, kind of going into the realm of, publishing itself and what my, publisher wants to see from me, when this is done. If the book does well, I mean, they'll want to keep seeing, more epic fantasy. I love epic fantasy and it's what I want to, kind of be known for. But I've got ideas in other things. I mean, I've got some young adult fantasy that's kind of sitting in the back of my head. I've got some, urban fantasy that I'd love to play around with. We'll see what Orbit says kind of after this book comes out, and we'll see how the book itself does.
For all you know, they might ask you to write a space western.
For all I know, they might. I kind of doubt it, though. That's more Daniel Abraham kind of territory.
No, I know. They probably wouldn't ask you because that'd be silly. All right. So we got book coming out February, and then as far as we know, next September, too. Not this September, but the following year for book three. Do you have any other kind of like short stories or anything like that, or even convention appearances you got coming up?
Not definitely. I'm really hoping, and I've even actually reserved a hotel room and everything and bought my membership for Worldcon in Texas. I'm 90% going to that unless something comes up. So Worldcon. And nothing else planned right now. My publisher is mulling over the idea of sending me to like one or two kind of local places for me that are more like 4 or 5 hour drives instead of not a real tour or anything. But if that ends up coming to fruition, then I'll definitely make an announcement about it.
Awesome, and I will get to see you at Worldcon. So,
oh, that'll be awesome.
Yep, I will shove a microphone in your face. And
oh, that sounds delightful.
Yeah, so that'll be good. Yeah, and Worldcon, I'm sure you'll have a blast.
I love Worldcon. I've gone to 3 Worldcons now. Last Chicago this last year was my first Worldcon that I was actually part of the industry. And it was such a weird difference going from being a fan to being, one of the people who, people actually come up and shake my hand kind of thing. And I was like, whoa, it was a completely different world and different in a very awesome way.
And at this one, you have people asking you to sign their copy of your book.
I know, and that's going to be even more different, and I'm actually very much looking forward to it. I think that will be so much fun.
You'll have to ask him about that, Sean, when you put the microphone in his face.
Yeah, I may or may not bring my copy of your book. I might have to buy a new one when I'm there.
That would be horrible if you had to buy another book.
I know. Well, I have this thing about I don't really like giving money to authors, so I'm just that's a total lie. But it's more of a, like, I have a suitcase and it can't go over 50 pounds.
So. Yeah, no, and it's a hardcover, so it's even bigger than, like, a paperback or something.
Yeah, yeah, so I'm probably going to end up, like, shipping a box to myself, which makes me feel so pathetic, but at the same time, I love it, so.
Yeah.
Excellent. So, okay, so you've got that going on. You're going to be at Worldcon unless basically the moon crashes into the Earth, which I hope that doesn't happen.
Me too.
Yeah, that would suck, right?
It would really put a damper on my burgeoning career.
Well, at that point, we're just all going to get drunk. Like, whatever, man.
Yeah, I'm done with this.
There's no point. Gravity's going to go to hell. It's just, yeah, whatever. But where can people find you on the internets?
I'm reasonably active on the interwebs. My website I update once in a while, and blog is www.brianmcclellan.com, and that's BrianMcclellan. Forgot to spell my own last name for a minute there.
That's okay. I've had students misspell their own names, so.
Well, I'm actually supposed to be a professional, so.
But you corrected yourself. They turn it in with their name spelled wrong on it.
Oh, good.
So you would have stopped and went, wait, no, that's not right, and then you would have fixed it, and then I would have never known. So,
yeah. and then I'm on Twitter at BrianTMcClellan.com, or I guess not .com, just at BrianTMcClellan.
I keep forgetting the T in tweets, and I keep screwing up because there's other Brian McClellans, and it's like, no, wrong Brian!
Yeah, I didn't manage to get the straight-up Brian McClellan, unfortunately.
It's just like Gary Wolf. If you don't put in the K, you get the wrong Wolf.
Yeah, I've had, Orbit, you know, like, added the person that has just Brian McClellan for, like, the first week that, you know, we were kind of announcing things on Twitter for the book, and I finally sent them an email. I was like, I just noticed that you're not, you know, coming to me with these.
That's hilarious.
So there is someone somewhere named Brian McClellan that was very confused.
That's awesome. I'm just glad there's only one other person who has my name. And he's an actor who is not very active, and I don't even know if he has a Twitter, so.
Good.
Otherwise, it'd be really weird if, like, I get all these tweets because I'm a famous actor all of a sudden. I'm like, wait, what? I wasn't in that movie, but okay, I would go along with it after a while. I was like, yeah.
That's you, yeah.
What was it like working with Nick Nolte? You know, he's crazy. Yeah. If you think, no, I'm not going to go, sorry. Anyway, okay, so book is coming out at the recording of this podcast, it'll be Tuesday, which is the 16th of April. So everybody should go check it out, particularly if you want something that's a little different in terms of, like, it's not just another epic fantasy with, like, evil bad, it's not Tolkien again. not that Tolkien's bad, but I love it because I'm just I really wanted a change in scenery, and I got guns, and it was awesome. It may also be because I also like explosions.
Well, who doesn't? I mean, I know Michael Bay does.
I knew. Oh, that was exactly what I was thinking. You know, except he doesn't understand how a good explosion works. You do.
Yeah, I don't know if I do, but I try to fake it well.
Well, don't worry. When we make Transformers 15, I'll hire you as explosion expert.
Fantastic, because you're going to be a famous actor by then.
I know. I'll do the film with Nick Nolte.
Yeah.
We'll put him in a cardboard suit and call him Optimus Prime.
I would watch that, actually.
Especially if it was Nick Nolte.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's what I'd watch it for, especially because by that point he's going to be like 95.
Just imagining that I'm okay. Anyway, so go check out his book, go to his website, brianmcclellan.com, go to his Twitter, put the T in between Brian and McClellan. And other than that, thank you very much, Brian, for babbling with us for a little over an hour.
No problem. Thank you for having me on. It was very much fun.
Excellent. All right, we will see everybody else on the flip side. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet. Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.